This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
Our debt has been falling consistently while protecting those who need protection. Is now really the time to change that successful strategy?
As rebellion grows on the Tory backbenches, are cracks starting to appear in George Osborne's plan to cut tax credits? Also this week, as Britain rolls out the red carpet for the Chinese president and his chequebook, Britain's steel industry goes into meltdown. Does Britain's industrial policy make any sort of sense? Plus, how to rally a group of fired-up activists to achieve real political change. We hear from Labour's equality spokeswoman Kate Green on the new film Suffragette. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian commentators Anne Perkins and Aditya Chakraborty and The Observer's economics editor Heather Stewart. A warm welcome to you all. Now, when George Osborne announced that he would be cutting tax credits for working people, he suggested that any losses would be balanced out by a hike in the minimum wage. They were, he stressed still, the party of working people. But as evidence mounts that families are standing to lose hundreds, maybe even thousands of pounds a year under the new system, Tory backbenchers, supporters and their media allies are beginning to get cold feet. Aditya, when in the last parliament, the Tories set up a kind of narrative, didn't they, about benefits? Skivers on the one hand, people lying on their sofa with the blinds drawn, and strivers who went out to work on the other. But it's looking a bit like that distinction's being tested to destruction, isn't it?
It's fascinating, Tom. If you think back to the past 5 years, the media took up this Skivers v Strivers narrative with great enthusiasm, not least among them the Sun newspaper. When things have really begun to change in the last couple of months has been basically because the Sun came out just before the Tory party conference and started pointing out how unfair the tax credit cut was. Mm. It's not really been because of Jeremy Corbyn. It's not really been because of anything the Labour Party have done. Actually, the Sun seemed to be the effective opposition to this. And that's what's given people like Heidi Allen the wobbles.
Anne, do you think there's a good argument underneath it somehow here about weaning people off welfare and an economy that pays a wage? You know, they say low welfare but higher wages.
There's a strong political strategic argument, which we've heard former chancellors like Ken Clark and Lord Nigel Lawson make, which is that, you know, you've got to do the bad stuff early on. But they never tell the whole truth. Yes, it is true and startling that the money spent on tax credits has expanded hugely. But the explanation for that is that an awful lot of people over the last 5 or 6 years have taken little or no nothing in the way of pay increases, and consequently, there are a lot of people who are on much lower pay than they would have been had the economy grown at its predicted rate. So there really isn't any reason that fits in with the kind of overall Tory narrative of being the party of the striver and of the worker.
And yet they do have this minimum wage increase, Heather, that's coming in. Are you completely convinced now that it's not going to be enough to compensate people?
No, it isn't, unfortunately. Resolution Foundation have done some work on this. For one thing, that it's happening more slowly, the increase in the minimum wage for the over 25s, over 5 years. But even if you did all of it right away, it still wouldn't compensate everybody, and a lot of those families would still lose out.
So it's a
separate policy.
With kids, or what's the difference?
Yeah, people with kids seem to do particularly badly because you get extra help through tax credits. It's also one of the reasons I think it's upset the Sun and even right wing think tanks like the Adam Smith Institute, is that one of the justifications for tax credits is that they were meant to help increase the incentive to get into work. You know, you think about Gordon Brown, who was very firmly of the view that work was the root out of poverty. That was the right thing to do. And so you topped up people's pay packets because you wanted to show very clearly to people that they would do better if they got off their sofas and went out to work. And that actually, if you, for example, one of the things that the new rules will do is to lower the number of hours you can work before your tax credits are withdrawn. Well, that gives you less of an interest in getting off that sofa and going out to work. And the Adam Smith Institute, the very right wing think tank, came out against this week for exactly that reason, because they fear that it dulls work incentives.
And yet, didn't people like yourself, Aditya, on the left, sometimes worry that the, you know, that this was subsidising low pay, you know, almost the opposite of the Adam Smith argument, which Adam Smith Institute, rather than Adam Smith himself, whose views on tax credits I can't claim to know. But that actually, you know, this is great for business because it lets them pay too little. And that's what we've been seeing.
A classic example of the visible hand helping poverty paying employers. I mean, I do agree with that. I think actually, if you look at how much now employers rely upon the state to pay the way for their employees, it is shocking. It's gone up a lot since Thatcher's time.
So isn't this the right mix then? Force the employers to pay more and get rid of some of these tax credits?
No, listen to what Heather just said. The national minimum wage turning into a living wage and all the rest of it, that's not gonna make good the shortfall. I'd believe that Osborne was a representative of the workers if he wanted to put in more workforce representation in companies rather than cut back on trade union powers. If he actually did want to institute a proper living wage, then I'd go along with that. That would all be fine. But this isn't what's happening. I think that what's really interesting, though, is this. We've got £12 billion of welfare cuts, which are meant to be coming at us. We've got a spending review, which is meant to be coming next month. So we've got these cuts, which are plugged into the government's programme. And so far, the government's been able to say to the electorate, well, all these cuts we're making, they're affecting someone else, actually someone less deserving than you. One of the dirty secrets of the British economy is actually more of us rely upon the state to a greater extent than it's been previously recognised or acknowledged in debate. Actually, the state supports employers to a huge degree. So all of a sudden, you're going to be going into cuts and a cut like this proves to be unpopular. How many other cuts prove to be unpopular? Because if Osborne keeps on making cut after cut after cut, he starts cutting into the people who turned out to vote for him. Just like that woman who spoke up on Question Time a week ago.
I voted Tory, but now
exactly.
You're taking
shame
my tax.
On you. Yeah.
Yeah. Heather, do you have a sense? Obviously, there's going to be a few more weeks yet before we know what's in the, I don't know if it's pre-budget or the autumn statement,
review. It's both, I think. The autumn statement and a spending review.
That'll be a very fun day.
Yeah. And is it going to be, you know, on the Richter scale or whatever, how big do you think the cuts we're going to see are going to be? Do you think this tax credits will look like one among many by the time we're through?
Yes, I think it will. What we're going to see is how deep the cuts to different departments are going to be over the next 5 years. So we know what Osborne wants to do. He's got this fiscal charter that he's made a great thing of. He wants to deliver a budget surplus. He wants to balance the budget before the end of this parliament. And, you know, it means another very deep set of cuts. And what we'll get to see on the 25th of November when he announces the details is exactly how much each department how deeply each department will have to cut. And it's another interesting question that Aditya's talking about, when the cuts start to become too much. And it's interesting, I think the Tories felt quite emboldened by the fact that they'd actually done a reasonable amount of austerity over the last parliament, and it didn't really seem to be affecting people. You know, there was the odd march against Sure Start centres being cut or libraries or whatever else. But actually, it's attrition, this. It's a slow undermining of you know, the public realm, of, you know, how much councils can spend on, you know, whether it's emptying your bins or, you know, rebuilding your school or whatever else. And you do wonder, I don't know when we reach that point, but you do wonder eventually whether people will decide they've had enough and they, you know, they feel this period of austerity has gone on for long enough.
There's some more immediate crunches, though, aren't there, Anne, as well as the slower burning thing around tax credits. And I mean, if they were wanting to give ground, they'd rather do it in this November statement as part of a more balanced overall package or part of the plan. But there's some question that they might have to give ground sooner because of the House of Lords or another vote in the House of Commons.
Yes, I think it was very clear at Prime Minister's questions yesterday that they're already setting up the idea that the House of Lords is interfering in a money measure, which it's not by convention supposed to do. As you, Tom, spotted the other day, if this really is a money measure, why has it never been any part of financial legislation? They're doing it entirely as a sort of statutory instrument. They're doing it in an underhand way. Seems to me to be perfectly reasonable for the House of Lords to tackle it head on.
You're right, though. I was just watching George Osborne appearing before the Treasury Select Committee this morning, and he was very much playing that line, that this is, you know, constitutionally dodgy because the Lord shouldn't be interfering in a finance matter.
My prediction is that we've already hit peak Osborne and that you should sell your shares in Osborne now, because things for him are going to get a lot worse.
Who are you buying, Aditya?
I think Sajid Javid.
He's got a great backstory, but what's his sort of offer? What's his? Where is he? Where's he coming from?
He is a less encumbered, less ideological version of Osborne. So he's got none of the history of the recent policymaking history of Osborne, and he's not as hated as Osborne.
But is only he because he's not so known, though, right? Yeah. Yeah. He's not hated because he hasn't actually done anything.
This is going to be quite important over the next 3 or 4 years, is finding a Tory who's not known and therefore hated by the public.
Let's use this mention of Javid, who's the industry secretary who refuses to use the word industrial strategy because it's too dirigiste. And too heavy-handed to segue into this question of China, because if we do have an industrial strategy now, Aditya, it is about rolling out the red carpet to the Chinese president.
We do have an industrial strategy.
And
it's called Get China to Fund It and Get the French to Build It. That seems to be the result of this week, doesn't it?
Dinner with the Royals and then £40 billion worth of contracts for British industry. So we've got a policy that recognises the need for state aid.
Yes, state aid to other states, unfortunately. I do think this is, again, just to come back to your point about personalities, Tom, notice Sajid Javid hasn't been in all the photo ops. It's been Osborne leading it, not even Cameron, actually, as much as George Osborne. It's really interesting. There's three things that seem to be coming together that seem to be apparent in these deals that are being made. One is that Britain, because of the fiscal chart and all the cuts that Heather was talking about earlier, Britain doesn't want to do any public infrastructure, or do as little public infrastructure as possible on its own balance sheet. So it wants to use other countries' balance sheets to do it. And so EDF will charge us a lot more to build a nuclear station at Hinkley because it's going to borrow from the market, which is going to be much more expensive than if a government were to borrow. The second thing that seems to have happened is that we actually have gone through 30 years of deindustrialisation and ripping out our supply chains. So that even Osborne now, when he turns up in Parliament and talks about why we're going to EDF for Hinkley, says, well, actually, there's no one left in the country who can design and build a thing. We have to go abroad. And the third thing that seems to happen is that China, which had next to no nuclear 10 years ago in its own country, is now building nuclear like Bilyeu across its own country and is now exporting to us. And once they've got a British showpiece, they'll be able to go and sell their nuclear expertise to Qatar, Pakistan, wherever. I mean, it's amazing. It's if you want to look at industrial strategy, look at what China's doing, because they've decided two things. One, we'll go really heavy on nuclear. Two, that we will put as much money as it takes to build up expertise in nuclear. So they bought all their designs from Westinghouse. They naturalised the expertise of the Westinghouse engineers. And now within 10 years, they're exporting to us. It's amazing.
And yet, I mean, it's Aditya's making it sound like a kind of globalised PFI, Heather, but I mean, this is the most important and fastest growing big economy, isn't it, still in the world, despite its recent problems. And we need a piece of the action, don't we, if we're...
Well, Osborne is making a bet that earlier in China's development, when it's been incredibly heavily dependent on infrastructure spending, other countries, Germany, for example, have been great at exporting to China, you know, exporting capital goods, machinery, machine tools, all the kinds of things in which they have specialisms. Osborne is thinking that, you know, what Britain is particularly good at is the sort of services, isn't it? It's financial services, it's our management consultants, it's all those kinds of things, tourism, education. China is now in the phase of its development where we can really sell them things. And, you know, arguably we should be looking to these markets, but it doesn't strike me that it therefore follows that we should be bending over backwards in order to, or kowtowing, whichever you want to use, in order to get them to build out our energy supply system.
And do you think any of this kind of pageantry that's, you know, these discussions that are going on that are obviously about infrastructure and bringing in Chinese investment, are they going to do anything about opening the businesses of Shanghai to use, you know, British management consultants rather than, I don't know, French ones or American ones or whoever else?
Of course not.
I suspect it slightly raises awareness of Britain as a country. But, you know, China analysts that I speak to say when China thinks of Europe, it thinks Germany first, France second, probably the UK third, you know, which is to do with the size of, you know, economies rather than any sort of lavish banquets or trips or... whatever else.
Heather's exactly right. If it's one thing to do what Germany's doing with China, which is sell the Chinese machines to make machines with. That's what they're doing. The other, but what we seem to be doing is saying, well, we can sell you services, except China's got a different legal system. It's got a different language, obviously. It's got a completely different culture. If you want to do the kind of thing that Chancellor Osborne is talking about, sell services to the rest of the world, then really you'd want to do that with the Commonwealth, not China. However big a market China is, it doesn't have that much demand for what you're selling. India might do. I can see that.
But we are going to make a Chinese version of the BBC television series Coast Ditcher. So that's balance of trade.
It really, if you look at it from a political rather than an economic or an industrial strategic point of view, the different ways that administrations ever since the end of the 1970s have used to replace the taxpayer as the source of income for investing in the state. So Thatcher had oil, and she used oil to reconstruct, but most of the post-war, a good part of the post-war settlement. Gordon Brown used the city, and now George Osborne's using China. And, you know, each one is because of a political reluctance, admirably supported by the research about what voters are prepared to put up with, that we aren't prepared to pay for it.
But there's also a sort of nagging feeling, Anne, isn't there, is there the kind of industrial tax base there to tax even if you wanted to? Aditya's bemoaning the decline of supply chains. I mean, look at what's been happening with steel in the last couple of weeks. What do you think governments could be doing if they wanted to start making things again?
There must be investment in order to increase hugely the technological levels of the steel, in this case, that we offer. But whenever I hear that, I think, but actually, SSI spent £1 billion on Redcar, and they still couldn't get it turning out steel of a kind and at a price that the world wanted. So you kind of think that's probably quite a limited objective. I mean, again, the kind of sort of textbook says, well, you need to kind of throw everything at retraining, reskilling people for the future industries. And that also is supposed to be happening, but you just don't see it happening. And I guess it's pretty hard to say to steelworkers, I hope you don't mind losing your job for a few years, but you know, in 5 years' time, your kids, even if not you, will know how to build wind turbines. I mean, it's a really, really hard thing to do.
Can you see a way through it? I mean, Savi Javid, who we've been talking about, we know his instinct is for the light touch, but the government are getting wary now, aren't they?
They are, and the history of taking a light touch approach to this, it's just that you get hollowing out and hollowing out and hollowing out. And you know, we still haven't really answered the question. Or, you know, there is a strand of, even as a kind of good lefty, that thinks some of these jobs, you know, mining jobs and so on, they were skilled and they had a sort of huge, they were great communities, those, but they were bloody hard, you know, dirty, smelly, messy jobs. And, you know, it would be great to think that our economy had developed to a point where we didn't need to rely on that anymore. However, we've never answered the question really of what we replace it with. We've never answered that question. And a lot, you know, you still have high unemployment in a lot of those areas. And, you know, maybe you attract an Amazon distribution centre or whatever, but those jobs are, you know, involve long hours and are bloody hard as well. So it's very hard. I don't think we have a solution, and there are all kinds of, you know, kind of long-term things you might do, having some kind of state-backed investment bank, for example, which is an idea that's gone round and round, but you know, to make it easier to start up new industries and so on. But it's hard to come up with there is no easy solution to it, I don't think.
We do still have loads of dirty, smelly jobs.
We do.
Cleaning, you know, working in crappy distribution centres, whatever. It's just that they're not unionised and they don't pay as well as the old dirty, smelly jobs.
And they're less secure, in fact.
Yeah. What's so fascinating about the steel thing is it shows up yet again, like 30 years of an orthodoxy, which is basically let the market sort it out. Let's have more competition. So therefore, if we can't compete with Chinese steelmakers, then we must go down. And the other thing is, well, we'll do retraining and clear up the mess, which is what Keith Jones said, which is what Ed Ball said, you know, which is what we seem to be hearing from this current administration. The problem is, you can retrain workers all you like, but if there's no jobs for them to go into.
Retraining for what?
For what, yeah. Exactly.
Well, as always, you can follow the dying embers of the week's news on theguardian.com/politics.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Women should not exercise judgment in political affairs.
If we allow women to vote, it will mean the loss of social structure.
That's the trailer for the new film Suffragette, out in cinemas this week, and it's renewed a debate about how far direct action and protest can go to achieve legitimate political ends. Our correspondent Frances Perrodin spoke to Labour's equality spokeswoman Kate Green this week to get her take.
It's important to remember that there were different movements all seeking to achieve the right to vote for women. So there was the suffragette movement. Some of those women became more militant in their tactics as time went on, as they became more frustrated that they weren't succeeding, and indeed as they were being treated so aggressively and abusively by the state, the force feeding, the Cat and Mouse Act that meant they were in and out of prison, and the very, very hostile and brutal response of the state authorities. But there were other movements in parallel, for example, the suffrage movement led by Millicent Fawcett, which sought to take a constitutional approach to change. Sometimes there were tensions between those different approaches, but I think what's important to recognise is that there were a whole range of different ways that women fought for the vote. And looking back now, I think it's easy to say, well, we needed all of those different approaches. At the time, of course, there was a very live debate about which one was right. And I guess you see the same kind of tensions in all campaigns today, how strident, how assertive you might need to be. And the truth is that you need to advance on all fronts. And if you're not being listened to, then it's hardly surprising that people will resort to more forceful tactics.
And the fight isn't over yet. So what is the kind of modern day suffragette cause as you see it?
Well, in terms of representation of women in public life, although we've made great strides, and obviously we do all have the vote now, we still have very significant underrepresentation of women, for example, in Parliament, where still fewer than a quarter of women of MPs are women. Labour's doing pretty well now. We're at over 40%. The Conservative Party, only 21% of their MPs are women, and that is an improvement in the Conservative Party in recent years. But we still have fewer women in Parliament today, elected in 2015, than there have been men elected in the whole history of Parliament, all the many hundreds of years that we've had a Parliament. So clearly we are significantly underrepresented both in the history of Parliament, inevitably, but also still to this day. And we have to address that. And we have to address, too, the increasing disaffection of young people, and including young women, from the electoral and political process. They're not registering to vote. They're not participating in elections. Of course, if they're not voting, if they're not registering, their voice isn't being heard. And that's a real concern and a real challenge, I think, for people like me in the political process.
Labour's Kate Green there. And, of course, this is one of Jeremy Corbyn's themes, isn't it? That there might be laws, there might be situations in which you don't want to stick by the rules. But do you think lawmakers can ever dabble with being lawbreakers like that?
I think it must be impossible for lawmakers to be lawbreakers. But at the same time, it's hard to imagine how as big a thing as votes for women, I mean, it's so ridiculous when you look at it now to say it was a big thing, but it was a big thing, could have been achieved without the sheer determination of those women. One of the perhaps weaknesses about the film is not being a little bit more nuanced about how difficult it is to change people's ideas about what are appropriate roles. And, you know, when you're kind of overwhelmed with the rightness of your idea, you tend perhaps to exclude the difficulties even quite normal and intelligent other women have in kind of reshaping how they think about it.
So you'd like to see a film about the role of persuasion, perhaps, in the extensions of the franchise. Persuasion at Westminster this week, Aditya, the question is Labour's new head of communications and strategy, someone who's known to us all, the former Guardian columnist Seamus
Current Guardian
Milne.
Columnist still, isn't he?
Well, once and future Guardian.
Exactly. He's only going away for a bit, isn't he?
And if he is, I mean, is that telling? He's certainly got his work cut out, hasn't he?
I think what's really interesting about Seamus's appointment, just to be full disclosure, before we start talking about him, he's obviously a colleague of ours. We sit in the same party office as him. I don't know him particularly well, but I like the cut of his jib. I like the cut of his suits more. As soon as he's been appointed, people say, oh, well, this is just exactly the kind of mistake Jeremy Corbyn would make. You know, here he is appointing this Stalinist, Trotskyist, whatever he apparently is. And what I find fascinating about this is there's an attempt to try and make certain ideas out of bounds. The same thing that was actually applied to Jeremy Corbyn is that, oh, he's too far left, he's too mad. They're now saying about his newly appointed spokesperson, oh, he's too mad, he's too far left. Well, actually, Jeremy Corbyn won the Labour leadership election by a convincing majority. Seamus Milne's ideas, if you look at the ones that I know about on domestic policy, especially on economics, they seem to be perfectly sensible, actually, a lot of what he says. The madness seems to be in trying to say that actually that the economy we've got is somehow decent and working sustainably, rather than trying to point out the failures in it.
Well, I suppose at the very least, Heather, it suggests that we're not about to see Jeremy try and spin himself into looking like some kind of middle of the road moderate. But without going too in-house, you've worked with Seamus a bit on the union's side, where he's had to be able to, the Guardian's in-house union, I mean, he's had to be able to cut deals and talk to people on the other side, as well as just write a strident column, hasn't he?
Yes, I think you'll find he's a formidable advocate for whatever cause he's promoting. He's a he's a serious person.
He's also a mean strategist, I think. I think he has a very sophisticated understanding of where the points of power are and how they're organised. You may or may not share it, but he's very coherent and very articulate.
I guess if he does the
and
job,
very charming.
If he does the job well, we won't be talking about the charming Mr. Milne very much, because press officers don't want to become the story. There's not that many people in the Westminster Village who are behind Jeremy Corbyn, but one parliamentarian who was Michael Meacher, who's died at the age of 75 this week. Let's just have a quick final word on him.
Well, he will be missed. He was one of those people who was absolutely unimpeachably uncorruptible. People who remember the laughter when he was discovered to have extensive property holdings might question that. But I don't think nobody would ever for a moment suggest that he did anything venal himself. That he was also immensely earnest about his points of view, so earnest that he once sued Alan Watkins for saying that he wasn't working class, which obviously brought down the scorn of the whole Chatterati upon his head. I always thought he was a very decent bloke.
Did you?
I was actually thinking about him when we were talking about Seamus earlier, is that there's someone else who actually had a number of sensible views. He came out against the Iraq war. In the end, he was a fierce critic of the kind of economy we're in, and he wanted a fairer country. And for 20 years, he was laughed at as being a slightly marginal, eccentric figure. And yet, somehow, there is still currency in those ideas. In fact, they're more popular than ever.
OK, let's leave that there. My thanks to Anne, to Aditya and to Heather. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.